This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 1995 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each question twice. Question 1. Your friend is shopping for some new trainers. Which pair does she decide to buy?
I think I'll go for the black ones I tried on first. These green and white ones look really great, but I don't think they'll last very long.
Question 2. Sally is trying to buy a return ticket for the bus into town. Why can't she get one?
I'm sorry, but we don't issue returns before 9 a.m. It's not even 8:30 yet. I'm sorry, but we don't issue returns before 9 a.m. It's not even 8:30 yet.
Question 3. You are trying to find the tourist information office and ask a passerby for directions. Where exactly in Dobson Street is it?
Oh, yes, it's in Dobson Street. You can't miss it. Big white building, next to the bank. Right across from what used to be a garage, I think, but what's now a small supermarket. Oh, yes, it's in Dobson Street. You can't miss it. Big white building, next to the bank. Right across from what used to be a garage, I think, but what's now a small supermarket.
Question 4. Your father is about to go to your uncle's house. Why is he going there?
Well, I sometimes wonder what your Uncle Sean would do without us. Last week, your mother had to go over to help out with your new cousin. Now they've broken a window in the kitchen, and they want me to fix it. Families. Well, I sometimes wonder what your Uncle Sean would do without us. Last week, your mother had to go over to help out with your new cousin. Now they've broken a window in the kitchen, and they want me to fix it. Families.
Question 5. Your geography class has been moved to another room. What, according to your teacher, is the problem with this new room?
4C6? Well, that's no use. It's big enough for 25 people, I suppose. But I wanted to show that video on Tibet, and it's impossible to get the equipment up those stairs. Well, that's no use. It's big enough for 25 people, I suppose. But I wanted to show that video on Tibet, and it's impossible to get the equipment up those stairs.
Question 6. Marie's father is talking to her hockey coach. Why can't Marie play in next week's match? And why would a rearranged appointment not help?
It looks as if Marie's not going to be able to play that day, I'm afraid. We made an appointment for her to go to the dentist's ages ago. I was going to rearrange the appointment for the day before, and apparently we could do that. But she's having two teeth taken out, and I don't think she'll be feeling much like hockey after that. It looks as if Marie's not going to be able to play that day, I'm afraid. We made an appointment for her to go to the dentist's ages ago. I was going to rearrange the appointment for the day before, and apparently we could do that. But she's having two teeth taken out, and I don't think she'll be feeling much like hockey after that.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at part two, exercise one. Part 2. Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to this information about using the town sports centre and complete the notes below. You will hear the information twice.
Now, just a few words about rules and regulations that you'll need to know if you're to become regular users of the sports centre. First, very important, we'd like each of you to provide us with details of your state of health and fitness. If you've had any serious illnesses or injuries, it's very important that your instructor knows about them. Next, clothing and equipment. For the aerobic step workout sessions, you must have suitable trainers. The instructor will not let you join in the session if you don't, as you will strain and possibly injure your knee joints. And talking about appropriate footwear, please check that your shoes are non-marking, especially if you're using the squash courts. We don't want black marks all over our beautiful and very expensive floors. For the serious swimmers, we have lane swimming every weekday morning. That's Monday to Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. And diving sessions, Monday to Friday, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. And also on Saturday and Sunday, from 11:15 a.m. to 12:15. Anyone wanting to do weight training should see the supervisor. He will draw up a suitable training program for you, which you should follow. We don't want any messing about with weights. That could cause serious and permanent injury.
Now you will hear the information again.
Now, just a few words about rules and regulations that you'll need to know if you're to become regular users of the sports centre. First, very important, we'd like each of you to provide us with details of your state of health and fitness. If you've had any serious illnesses or injuries, it's very important that your instructor knows about them. Next, clothing and equipment. For the aerobic step workout sessions, you must have suitable trainers. The instructor will not let you join in the session if you don't, as you will strain and possibly injure your knee joints. And talking about appropriate footwear, please check that your shoes are non-marking, especially if you're using the squash courts. We don't want black marks all over our beautiful and very expensive floors. For the serious swimmers, we have lane swimming every weekday morning. That's Monday to Friday, 7 to 9 a.m. And diving sessions, Monday to Friday, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. And also on Saturday and Sunday, from 11:15 a.m. to 12:15. Anyone wanting to do weight training should see the supervisor. He will draw up a suitable training program for you, which you should follow. We don't want any messing about with weights. That could cause serious and permanent injury.
That is the end of exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for exercise 2. Exercise 2. Questions 8 to 12. Now you will hear a radio broadcast about buying a second-hand car. Listen to the broadcast and complete the notes below. You will hear the broadcast twice.
As a nation, the English are extremely keen on buying second-hand cars. But are we aware enough of the dangers and pitfalls in buying a second-hand car? Here to give us some advice is Judy Godson from the Observer magazine.
Take your time and use your common sense when buying a car. Some of the main dangers are the car will have been stolen, the mileage recorded on the car will have been lowered, or the car will have a major fault that has been covered up for the sale. Remember that there are a lot of second-hand cars available, so you don't need to be in a hurry.
Small ads are popular. Are there any problems with these?
Well, people want to cut costs by buying from a small advert rather than going to a dealer. They think they will get a genuine, ordinary person trying to sell his own or auntie's car. But if you're buying from a small advert in the paper, read all the adverts very carefully. If you see the same telephone number several times in different ads, be on your guard. That's probably a dealer who's masquerading as an honest person, but actually has lots of dodgy second-hand cars to get rid of.
What about viewing the car?
Never arrange to see the car anywhere except outside the seller's house. Oh, certainly don't go to a pub, outside a phone box, or any of those places.
Do you recommend car auctions?
Well, car auctions are popular places to buy cars, but they can be tricky. The action is very fast, and you often can't see the car properly beforehand. They are cheaper than the big car dealers, but on the other hand, you'll get more legal protection from the big second-hand dealers.
What does help?
Some mechanical knowledge of what you should be looking for. Motoring organisations provide a thorough inspection and charge about £100, so it's worth going to one of those for help. After all, that's not very much money when you think a car may cost thousands of pounds.
Right. Now, you're going to see a car. What should you do?
Bring a friend who knows about cars with you, and equip yourself with some basic tools. A mirror is useful for reflecting areas you can't see easily. A magnet will show whether the bodywork has been resprayed, and if there's a lot of filler, that won't attract a magnet. Pull up the carpets and look underneath. Do the seats look very saggy and worn? That can be a sign that the car has done a very high mileage.
And how should you pay?
Well, don't pay anything before you're satisfied. Most sellers want you to pay in cash, because that's more foolproof for them than a check. Many will accept a check drawn on a building society. If you pay by check, you have some chance of stopping it if the car turns out to be faulty.
Now you will hear the broadcast again.
As a nation, the English are extremely keen on buying second-hand cars. But are we aware enough of the dangers and pitfalls in buying a second-hand car? Here to give us some advice is Judy Godson from the Observer magazine.
Take your time and use your common sense when buying a car. Some of the main dangers are the car will have been stolen, the mileage recorded on the car will have been lowered, or the car will have a major fault that has been covered up for the sale. Remember that there are a lot of second-hand cars available, so you don't need to be in a hurry.
Small ads are popular. Are there any problems with these?
Well, people want to cut costs by buying from a small advert rather than going to a dealer. They think they will get a genuine, ordinary person trying to sell his own or auntie's car. But if you're buying from a small advert in the paper, read all the adverts very carefully. If you see the same telephone number several times in different ads, be on your guard. That's probably a dealer who's masquerading as an honest person, but actually has lots of dodgy second-hand cars to get rid of.
What about viewing the car?
Never arrange to see the car anywhere except outside the seller's house. Certainly don't go to a pub, outside a phone box, or any of those places.
Do you recommend car auctions?
Well, car auctions are popular places to buy cars, but they can be tricky. The action is very fast, and you often can't see the car properly beforehand. They are cheaper than the big car dealers, But on the other hand, you'll get more legal protection from the big second-hand dealers.
What does help?
Some mechanical knowledge of what you should be looking for. Motoring organisations provide a thorough inspection and charge about £100, so it's worth going to one of those for help. After all, that's not very much money when you think a car may cost thousands of pounds.
Right. Now, you're going to see a car. What should you do?
Bring a friend who knows about cars with you, and equip yourself with some basic tools. A mirror is useful for reflecting areas you can't see easily. A magnet will show whether the bodywork has been resprayed, and if there's a lot of filler, that won't attract a magnet. Pull up the carpets and look underneath. Do the seats look very saggy and worn? That can be a sign that the car has done a very high mileage.
Mm-hmm. And how should you pay?
Well, don't pay anything before you're satisfied. Most sellers want you to pay in cash, because that's more foolproof for them than a check. Many will accept a check drawn on a building society. If you pay by check, you have some chance of stopping it if the car turns out to be faulty. That is the end of part two. There will be a short break before you hear part three. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Exercise 1. Questions 13 to 18. Listen to the following extract from a radio program about music and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice. And that's the latest music news from the Caribbean. Now we turn the musical spotlight on matters European, and in particular, on the Eurovision Song Contest, arguably the world's biggest musical contest, and this year hosted by Ireland. Alan Turner gives us this.
Well, the weather was wet, but nothing seemed capable of dampening the enthusiasm of the organisers and participants at the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest in Ireland. And there was no doubt that they all felt that, while of course it was the taking part that was important, they'd succeeded in the contest's main objective, namely that of delivering to some 300 million TV viewers all over the continent some of the best music around. It may strike some of you as something of a miracle that a show of this size gets produced at all. But the Irish, who landed the job of hosting the contest because they came out top in 93, seemed to relish the challenge. To give you some idea of the organisational headaches, they had to organise 70 coaches, 20 shuttle buses, and 6 special trains, just to ferry the 3,000 singers, musicians, technical people, and so on, from their hotels to the arena. All a bit of a security nightmare, really. Though, after hearing some of the songs, I wouldn't object to the odd assassin sneaking in. Just a joke, of course. But to me, the most amazing thing about the whole affair is not the chaos, or the waiting, or the arguing, or the travelling, but the fact that I was surrounded by 3,000 people from 25 nations who actually believed that the Eurovision Song Contest was a really important musical event. Well, it did at least allow the Irish to show off their lovely country. But at times, I had the feeling I was watching a tourist advert rather than a serious musical experience. I actually felt a little sorry for the participants, who were never really off duty. Even during the unofficial occasions, they were sharply dressed and ever eager for a photo opportunity and a chance to tell the world a little more about themselves and their songs. And fascinating these interviews were, too. I learned a lot about the hobbies, habits, and families of the young and musically talented of Europe. Oh well, I'll just have to try to contain myself and hope that the next 12 months pass quickly so that we can once again enjoy the delights of the annual Eurovision Song Contest. Back to you, Jenny.
Now you'll hear the extract again. And that's the latest music news from the Caribbean. Now we turn the musical spotlight on matters European, and in particular, on the Eurovision Song Contest, arguably the world's biggest musical contest, and this year hosted by Ireland. Alan Turner gives us this.
Well, the weather was wet, but nothing seemed capable of dampening the enthusiasm of the organisers and participants at the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest in Ireland. And there was no doubt that they all felt that, while of course it was the taking part that was important, they'd succeeded in the contest's main objective, namely that of delivering to some 300 million TV viewers all over the continent some of the best music around. It may strike some of you as something of a miracle that a show of this size gets produced at all. But the Irish, who landed the job of hosting the contest because they came out top in 93, seemed to relish the challenge. To give you some idea of the organisational headaches, they had to organise 70 coaches, 20 shuttle buses, and 6 special trains just to ferry the 3,000 singers, musicians, technical people, and so on, from their hotels to the arena. All a bit of a security nightmare, really. Though, after hearing some of the songs, I wouldn't object to the odd assassin sneaking in. Just a joke, of course. But to me, the most amazing thing about the whole affair is not the chaos, or the waiting, or the arguing, or the travelling, but the fact that I was surrounded by 3,000 people from 25 nations who actually believed that the Eurovision Song Contest was a really important musical event. Well, it did at least allow the Irish to show off their lovely country. But at times, I had the feeling I was watching a tourist advert rather than a serious musical experience. I actually felt a little sorry for the participants, who were never really off duty. Even during the unofficial occasions, they were sharply dressed and ever eager for a photo opportunity and a chance to tell the world a little more about themselves and their songs. And fascinating these interviews were, too. I learned a lot about the hobbies, habits, and families of the young and musically talented of Europe. Oh well, I'll just have to try to contain myself and hope that the next 12 months pass quickly so that we can once again enjoy the delights of the annual Eurovision Song Contest. Back to you, Jenny. That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Exercise 2. Questions 19 to 24. Listen to this radio discussion about graphology, the science of handwriting analysis, and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the discussion twice.
Graphology, the science of handwriting analysis, is a fascinating subject. This morning, I have with me John Carter from the Society of Graphologists and Susan Browning, a psychologist, who will be telling us more about the advantages and disadvantages of handwriting analysis. John, what exactly is graphology?
Well, we believe that personality has two aspects. Mm-hmm. First, the outer aspect, which is the image we project, how we want to be seen by people in everyday life. This side of us is under our conscious control. And second, the ego or unconscious aspect of our personality, which is much more fundamental, our true identity, what we are really like.
So it's this unconscious aspect, the ego then, that handwriting experts are interested in?
Yes. We see handwriting as a means of discovering things about people. You see, everyone is taught to write at school. Mm-hmm. There's usually a model that the school adopts, and all children are taught to base their handwriting on that particular style. And styles change over the years. Children learning to write now will be using a different handwriting style from, say, 20 years ago. Even when two people are taught the same model of handwriting, their writing never looks quite the same. So handwriting is a unique expression of personality.
Surely other factors influence handwriting. For example, people lacking confidence with a pen who write very little will have different handwriting from someone who uses a pen a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Level of education and social circumstances influence the kind of writing people produce. Not to mention coordination and so on, which may well be influenced by hereditary characteristics.
Yes. What interests me is the apparently growing use of handwriting analysis to determine whether someone applying for a job would be capable of doing that job effectively.
Yes, it's becoming seen as a powerful tool to work out whether an applicant could cope under pressure when put in a highly stressful situation, for example. It's used in France, Germany, America, and increasingly in Britain.
But there is no scientific evidence of its value. There have been no long-term follow-up studies to show that candidates accepted for a job on the basis of handwriting analysis performed better in a job. What if someone is chosen for a job on the recommendation of a handwriting expert and turns out to be a poor choice?
Hard-headed businessmen use graphology in selection procedures because it works. There's a genuine interest in it. It's used, together with other tests of suitability, of course. In America, the results of research indicate a 90% agreement with findings in other tests. I've been working with a merchant bank in the city who faxed out handwriting samples to experts in Switzerland.
Candidates are put in a difficult position, aren't they? If they object to having their handwriting analysed, they'll be singled out as troublesome and rejected anyway.
Mm, that's true.
I think that this is quite wrong. It's an infringement of human rights. And candidates who are rejected for a job on the basis of a handwriting analysis ought to be able to see the report.
Isn't it more reasonable to turn people down on the basis of their response to relevant questions than on the way they've dotted their I's and crossed their T's? After all, when you send in a letter of application for a job, you make sure your writing is nice and neat and deliberate.
Exactly. And that's why we ask people to provide a sample of handwriting that they did at some earlier but still fairly recent time.
Ah.
It's essential that unconscious elements in the personality come out.
Well, this morning my husband picked up a note I'd scribbled and asked if I had written it, because it looked nothing like my usual handwriting. But I wonder what graphologists would make of that.
Now you will hear the discussion again.
Graphology, the science of handwriting analysis, is a fascinating subject. This morning, I have with me John Carter from the Society of Graphologists and Susan Browning, a psychologist, who will be telling us more about the advantages and disadvantages of handwriting analysis. John, what exactly is graphology?
Well, we believe that personality has two aspects.
Mm-hmm.
First, the outer aspect, which is the image we project, how we want to be seen by people in everyday life. This side of us is under our conscious control. And second, ego, or unconscious aspect of our personality, which is much more fundamental, our true identity, what we are really like.
So it's this unconscious aspect, the ego then, that handwriting experts are interested in?
Yes. We see handwriting as a means of discovering things about people. You see, everyone is taught to write at school.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually a model that the school adopts, and all children are taught to base their handwriting on that particular style. And styles change over the years. Children learning to write now will be using a different handwriting style from, say, 20 years ago. Even when two people are taught the same model of handwriting, their writing never looks quite the same. So handwriting is a unique expression of personality.
Surely other factors influence handwriting. For example, people lacking confidence with a pen who write very little will have different handwriting from someone who uses a pen a great deal.
Mm.
Level of education and social circumstances influence the kind of writing people produce, not to mention coordination and so on, which may well be influenced by hereditary characteristics.
Yes. What interests me is the apparently growing use of handwriting analysis to determine whether someone applying for a job would be capable of doing that job effectively.
Yes, it's becoming seen as a powerful tool to work out whether an applicant could cope under pressure when put in a highly stressful situation, for example. It's used in France, Germany, America, and increasingly in Britain.
But there is no scientific evidence of its value. There have been no long-term follow-up studies to show that candidates accepted for a job on the basis of handwriting analysis performed better in a job. What if someone is chosen for a job on the recommendation of a handwriting expert and turns out to be a poor choice?
Hard-headed businessmen use graphology in selection procedures because it works. There's a genuine interest in it. It's used, together with other tests of suitability, of course. In America, the results of research indicate a 90% agreement with findings in other tests. I've been working with a merchant bank in the city who faxed out handwriting samples to experts in Switzerland.
Candidates are put in a difficult position, aren't they? If they object to having their handwriting analysed, they'll be singled out as troublesome and rejected anyway. I think that this is quite wrong. It's an infringement of human rights. And candidates who are rejected for a job on the basis of handwriting analysis ought to be able to see the report.
Isn't it more reasonable to turn people down on the basis of their response to relevant questions than on the way they've dotted their I's and crossed their T's? After all, when you send in a letter of application for a job, you make sure your writing is nice and neat and deliberate.
Exactly. And that's why we ask people to provide a sample of handwriting that they did at some earlier but still fairly recent time.
Ah.
It's essential that unconscious elements in the personality come out.
Well, this morning my husband picked up a note I'd scribbled and asked if I had written it, because it looked nothing like my usual handwriting. But I wonder what graphologists would make of that.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.